everybody to the Gloucester Writers Center. Very happy this evening to have two Finish Line writers here reading their finished work. It's been a great pleasure here at the Writers Center to see that pieces start and end. The starting is always the easiest part, I think. Very excited here to have Barbara Boudreau and Jane Keddie. Barbara's going to read first. Barbara Boudreau's love of music and nature have guided her through life. With a background in nature and conservation interwoven with music, she traveled throughout the world and lived for 6 years in Hiroshima, Japan. She settled in Gloucester with her jazz drummer and sailor husband, Al. Together, they keep America's original art form alive. She is a state regional interpretive coordinator and a certified interpretive guide interpreting natural, cultural, and historic resources of Massachusetts. Very excited to have Barbara here. She's going to be reading from... She's going to introduce what she's reading because she knows it much better than I do.
This is so awesome. Thank you guys for coming. Isn't this a cool little space? If some of you have never been here before, it's just such a... Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Jane, for inviting me to join you, because this is actually Jane's show. This is the Jane Keddie show. And then she came to me and said, you know, Henry said I should pull another writer into it. And I have been so lazy about getting my second book out. It's been done for something like 2 years, right? And I've got a real job that takes a lot of time and energy, and so I just haven't gotten it done. So I thought this is a good kick in the pants, you know, for me to actually read from it and pretend that we're actually going to get it done. And then Jane is going to do my cover art for this second book, which is really exciting. The first book, The Frenchman, is for sale tonight for a very low price. It's a really fun read. It's just a great story. And as a lot of these projects are, you know, take wing and are given birth, it happens somewhere between the subconscious and the conscious. And the first scene of this book came to me in a dream. When we were sailing on our boat, my husband Al over there in the green shirt, who is the wine connection. If we run out of wine, he can go to Richdale's. So, I wrote down the first scene of this book, or this dream, and I thought, oh, this will be fun, and I just kept writing and writing, writing and writing, and he goes, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know, I'm just writing and writing. And I'd always wanted to write a book, so... I got it done in 2009, the one that Anne Lamont calls the shitty first draft, right? And I thought, whoa, I've written a book, right? That's only like an eeny weeny part of the work, which all comes much later when you have to improve and edit and da 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 da. And I published it in 2013. And before I published it, I was taking care of my mother. She had Alzheimer's and she was living with us. So I was spending a lot of time at home. And there is a challenge in November for anybody who wants to take the challenge called the NaNoWriMo November Month Challenge. You are challenged with writing a 50,000 word novel in 30 days. And I said, I can do that. It's only 1,666 words a day. Unless you get behind, and then it becomes like 3,300 words a day. And so The Frenchman ends kind of like, you know, there's a question at the end. And I thought, I really like these people in this book. I could do another one. So I wrote the sequel. And that was obviously a long time ago. So I'm going to read from the sequel. It's the title, The Death of the Frenchman, is not as much of a spoiler as you would think. Because, you know, besides my husband, I'm in love with this man. So I wouldn't think about killing him off. But it's like, right, makes you think. And he is, for those of you who don't know the story about Jean Lachance, he is a thief, and he escaped France, and he stole a bunch of money, and then went to a rendezvous, and was expecting to pick up the money, and instead, he met this young woman and her three children, and it changed his life. And so we are going to go back to that story a little bit as we investigate going on. Starts with Detective Guy Santino. Do you guys remember him? Who has been chasing this man for 2 years. Okay. The 4-hour drive to Tucson provided valuable thinking time. During the Richard Prescott Lily Parsons case, Santino had spent way too much time chasing them and not enough time getting to know them. The mistake might have cost him the case, and now they were long gone. Was this obsession driven by guilt? Guilt or insecurity, he wasn't sure which. Probably both. The case nagged him like a cranky wife. Perhaps it was that gut instinct they talked about. Rewinding the case in his mind was a fun game, and he did it deliberately and often. But now the odds had changed. They were in his favor. His ghost had a face and a name. Jean Lachance. Even the name sounded risky, sinister. The face was distinctive. People might remember him. But who? Who would be able to identify him? Lily's neighbors? Her landlord? Would it mean anything if he could be identified? It was the context that mattered. Lachance had spent time with Lily and the kids. The trail was cold as Alaskan February. What Santino needed was information about the money. The Frenchman was gone, had been gone for almost 2 years. Had he taken the money with him? Unlikely, that amount of cash. So, if he couldn't take it with him, where would he hide it? Santino had considered banks. It was a logical deduction. Visiting banks would have done no good without a face. But now he had a face. A face might give him a name if Lachance had used an alias. A name might produce a trail. The Prescott robbery had involved over $1 million in cash, an amount which was easy to move given plenty of time. Lachance had not had much time with Santino on his tail. From the day of the crime to Lachance's departure from Tucson, less than 3 weeks had elapsed. Legitimate deposits would have to be small to avoid raising flags and would have taken too long. A guy like Lachance would have done something else, like hide the money somewhere, wait for the heat to cool down, then come back and collect it. It could be buried so far out in the desert that no one would ever be able to find it. Or it could be hidden in a large urban setting right under everyone's noses. Whatever it was, it would be something simple. That's what Lachance would do, Santino thought. Lachance was also from this city. He would go where he was comfortable rather than an unfamiliar wild environment. Santino decided to start with the banks. Reopening the case brought him new life. His heart thumped in his chest and he felt vigorous, alive. Just the possibility. The possibility of discovering what they had done with the money was enough to expunge the failure of having blown the case. He glanced over to the passenger seat where Jean Lachance's 20-something-year-old face stared up at the headliner. He lifted the photo and placed it on the steering wheel. The eyes were distant, deep, secret. The face was strong and determined. This was the face of a warrior, a formidable rival. Santino had to be careful. Lachance was the kind of man who is capable of anything, particularly when cornered. The mugshot had been taken following his one arrest for burglary, and it wasn't Lachance's slip that had got him caught. One of his competitors had dropped a dime during the crime, Aaron had said. His capture was unavoidable, but that was the only time, and he wasn't locked up for long. The Paris police had not had the pleasure of Jean Lachance's company since then. Santino wondered what might have happened to the rat and shivered. LaChance was now close to 50 years old, and Santino didn't doubt his skills had sharpened. He gazed at the photo and tried to age the man in his mind. Had he seen him at the airport? Santino couldn't be sure, but he wouldn't miss again. That's the detective that's after Jean LaChance. So now, obviously, they are living elsewhere, but I'm not going to tell you where. Some of you know if you've read the book The Frenchman. And for reasons that I will leave as a mystery, he goes back to get the money. Jean LaChance is going to go back and collect the money. And of course, his woman, Lily, is terrified. She doesn't want him to leave. And he leaves anyway. And he's living this sort of, he was this guy, you know, like this thief and this really intrepid sort of warrior. And then he meets a woman and she just destroys his whole persona because he falls in love with her. And he's taking care of this little family. So now he's on his way back and he has to find his way back to his character so he won't get caught. Route 10 carried him mercifully out of the city. Buildings and houses began to disappear and he met fewer and fewer cars until he was alone. The long highway spearing the far horizon felt isolating and strangely comfortable. The sheer empty beauty of the desert brought an ache to his chest with the memory of his first sight of Lily. There was a price to pay for the love of a woman. Before Lily, he had been Jean LaChance and only Jean LaChance. Before Lily, he was able to handle, endure, walk away from anything without a look back. All of that had changed. He was now vulnerable to the emotions that had invaded his life. It was critical to shake that before he arrived in Tucson. He remembered the way, of course, and slowed the car as he approached Route 177. The house in the desert was less than 20 miles away, and a visit would only cost him a couple of hours. The surface of the dirt road would tell him if anyone lived there, in which case he'd turn around. Even with the detour, he could make Tucson by nightfall or stay somewhere on the road. Without knowing why, he needed to go there, to the place where he had fallen in love with Lily. He turned north on Route 177, and the two-lane road drew him towards his mark. Visions charged with sexual energy flew through his mind. The shy, beautiful woman, nights on the porch, the warm, fleshy red wine. Amazingly, it was the same time of year, so the landscape was unchanged. At mile marker 256, he pulled the car to the left side of the highway and got out to examine the dirt track. The track seemed narrower than he remembered. Desert brush encroached from the sides, Mother Nature reclaiming her custody. The ground was undisturbed, and berms of sand had formed across the track. No one had been there in a long time. He stood, tipped his head, and inhaled the hot desert air. The aroma quickened his heart. Eagerness drove him back to the car, and he turned down the road in the direction of the house. The bad road was worse than before, and the mile to the house endless. When he rounded the last corner, he stopped immediately, as he had done 2 years before. Nothing had changed. He could almost see 10-year-old Henry rounding the corner with the Winchester 22 gripped in one hand. His first view of Lily had been from right here. He sucked in a deep breath and drove to the front porch. Apart from the periodic peeps of desert birds, it was as still as a graveyard. His footfalls were surprisingly loud on the soft sand. LaChance stepped up on the porch and opened the screen door. Scurrying feet accompanied the creak of the door. The stench of ammonia clung to the dry, stale air. The kitchen had been left untouched. Five chairs stood askew around the wooden table. The surface was laced with tiny animal tracks and droppings. Dusty cookware sat on the shelves where Lily had left it. LaChance glanced into the narrow living room where he had slept, and continued through the kitchen and up the stairs. He checked the kids' rooms, which still contained some clothes and a few toys. The beds were torn apart, most likely by the cops who would have searched the house. He crossed the hall to Lily's bedroom door and stood for a moment before pushing it open. The room had been tossed. Clothing, sheets, pillows, and shoes lay in disarray on the floor. LaChance went to the closet and fingered the few articles of Lily's clothing dangling from tired wire hangers. He pulled out a blue blouse, held it to his face, and closed his eyes. Even after 2 years, her scent filled his nostrils. He folded the small blouse and shoved it into his front pocket. It was as close as he could keep Lily for now. He turned toward the bed. The mattress had been lifted and dropped to the side where it lay partly on the frame and slumped onto the floor. He grabbed the corner of the mattress to throw it on the bed frame, and a jolt of pain shot through his shoulder. He cursed, lay down, and closed his eyes. Evie might have been conceived here. The image of Lily's nude figure overtook his psyche, and he felt his body stir. Her presence was powerful in this room and created a warm, rhythmic flush throughout his body. The four magic days he had spent in this house rewound in his mind, shooting gophers with Henry, repairing the leak in the roof, eating with the family around the kitchen table, drinking wine with Lily on the porch late at night, and finally making love with her for the first time on this very bed. It was the beginning of his present life and the end of his former life of crime. His mind swam with the breadth of times and events since they had met here, how he had changed in 2 short years. LaChance suddenly understood why he was here. This was the close of the episode. It had to close for him to go on. The niggling doubt crippling his confidence had to end at this house. He must expunge Pierre Laporte, husband, father, businessman, and once again resurrect Jean LaChance, notorious, successful skilled thief. He had been that man for decades. There had to be a way back. He took a deep breath and held it captive. Minutes ticked by. His chest and head pounded and swelled with deprivation and launched his mind. Images of France began like a movie in his brain. Visions of all the jobs he had pulled accelerated in sequence from his subconscious. Doors and safes flew open. Escape was effortless. Complex plots and strategies came back in frames, spliced together in a furious assault on his senses. He was invisible, always armed and potentially dangerous. He feared nothing and no one. He controlled his environment and knew all the exits. He saw his fingers working the most intricate combinations. He traveled swiftly, silently. He was invincible. He was alone. It was like an acid trip. The experience was surreal, and LaChance had no way of tracking the time frame. It might have been 10 minutes or 2 hours. Images came and went, flashing in related sequences. Deep breathing provided the soundtrack. Snippets of French conversation narrated the film, which included faces he had not seen in many years. Abruptly, the vision stopped, and LaChance opened his eyes. He got up from the bed and crossed the room to the mirror above the bureau. The man staring back was Jean LaChance. He was ready. He drew the blouse from his pocket, folded it neatly, and deposited it on the bureau. Next came the photo of Lily and the kids, which he laid gently on the blouse. Without another glance at either, LaChance left the room, closing the door behind him. He descended the stairs and, with eyes fixed straight ahead, walked through the front door, got in his car, and drove away from the house in the desert for the last time. Now, do we have time? Do we have time for another one, or should we go on?
Not sure what time.
It's 8:06. You want to go on?
Yeah.
I mean,
move on.
Yeah, move on. So those are just two little snippets from the book, The Death of the Frenchman. And it's a fun story. And this is something that I have found that it is just so much fun to create a story and people, to actually create people. And it's wacky because I feel like I know them. You know, it's like I have conversations with them and everything. Anyway, so that's just a little snippet, and I will now pass it on to Jane.
Jane Kenny is a printmaker and textile artist who has lived on Cape Ann for 35 years. She is a member of Gallery 53 on Rocky Neck, where she shows her prints and hand-painted and dyed silk scarves. Her memoir was 7 years in the making and follows her life path from the late 60s to the early 90s as she searches for love and connection. Very excited to hear from Serial Monogamy, and also I'm going to sneak a peek at the illustrations while she's reading because the books are back here on the back table.
This cover here is a silkscreen print that I did back in the 70s of a stove that I had in an apartment where I lived. At the beginning, this is a memoir in 7 parts, and each of the 7 parts represents a major relationship in my life. And I'm going to today read just little snippets from each of the 7 parts so you get a feel for what the book is about. And on each of the 7 parts, at the beginning is one of my silkscreen prints. In the book, they're all in black and white because it was only cost effective to do it that way. But you can see these if you want to see what they look like in color. And I also have a website, Kenny Graphics, where you can see the prints. So the first part takes place at the University of Connecticut in 1968. That's where it starts. And at the university is where I kind of went through a major change in my life from rushing a sorority and being a sorority sister to getting involved with a graduate student who was part of the Young Workers Liberation League, an arm of the Communist Party. So my whole view of the world changed. And during my first semester of my senior year, I was able to become part of a program at the university called Urban Semester, where they took 10 college students and brought them to the north end of Hartford, and where we lived and worked in social service agencies for a whole semester. Chapter 5, Urban Semester. My parents were not supportive of my decision to live in the slums of North Hartford after a long, hot summer of rioting had swept through the nation's inner cities. We had seen the TV reports of young black men looting stores and torching cars, running wild in the streets. I rationalized it as a normal reaction to years of oppression, but my parents perceived it simply as a danger to be avoided. Although my father opposed my plans, he knew he couldn't forbid me to go. My mother was recovering from yet another nervous breakdown and incapable of expressing much of anything. My dad finally agreed to drive me to Hartford for the beginning of Urban Semester that fall. He tried to talk me out of it the entire way there. The group of new Urban Semester recruits arrived one by one throughout the evening at the apartment complex where we would be living. Dr. Wogan was there to greet us and assure the parents that it was entirely safe to leave their precious progeny in this seeming hellhole. There were 10 of us. 4 men, 4 women, and 1 married couple. The couple got their own 1-bedroom apartment. The men were situated in 1 2-bedroom apartment and the women in another. We were all extremely white middle-class hippies. The anti-war movement had generated a countercultural shift among college students, resulting in a rebellion against all things middle class. I had exchanged my sorority attire, villager matching skirts and sweaters and knee socks worn with Baswegian loafers, for bell bottoms, tie-dye t-shirts, and construction boots. I also retired my hot rollers and hairspray and let my hair grow out, and now wore it in two skimpy braids. After unpacking and getting settled in our new home, we gathered for a dinner of spaghetti with canned sauce. Our apartment, the Chick's place, was where we came together for meals, since we, the Chicks, cooked, while the men preferred to graze or order takeout. Mike Wogan joined us for dinner and gave us some last words of wisdom and caution before he was on his way back to Yukon. After living so long under the oppression of whites, some black folks simply don't care any longer whether they get along with white folks, and there is a massive amount of work to be done to correct the situation which we, the white society, have created. You will be up against many obstacles. You will have to prove yourself worthy of these people's trust. And after much hard work, you may see little or no results. But keep at it, because change is made in little bits and pieces by individuals like yourselves. So after that experience, I ended up moving to a commune in Portland, Maine, with my graduate student boyfriend, and lived there for a year and decided it wasn't working, the relationship wasn't working, and I needed a break. So I moved back to the Boston area and rented a room in a house with four other women. And we discovered somewhere along the way about this really cool bar in Cambridge called the Plow and Stars. So this is part two, chapter two, the Plow. Eileen had heard about a bar in Cambridge called the Plow and Stars, a replica of an Irish pub, and frequented, it was rumored, by IRA, Irish Republican Army, fugitives and gun runners. We decided to check it out. After taking in a Hitchcock movie at the Orson Welles Theater, we made our way down Mass Ave towards Central Square, looking for the infamous bar. After cruising up and down for a while with no luck, we finally saw a wooden sign that read, "The Plow and Stars," and parked as close as we could. We couldn't see in. The large front window was covered by a curtain, and the door was solid wood with no windows. So we plunged in, opened the door, and a blast of noise and light hit us. The room was long and narrow like a railroad car. Running most of the length of the side was a wooden bar lined with patrons leaning and sipping and drinking their pints of Guinness, Harp, or Bass Ale. Along the right side of the room, a built-in wooden bench ran against the wall with small tables scattered down its length. All the seats were filled, and it seemed as if every inch of the small space was occupied by bodies. We elbowed our way up to the bar and ordered two pints of Bass Ale, a reddish gold liquid with a frothy head. We stood there, unable to move, until a spot opened up at the bar and we leaned in, out of the flow of traffic. This bar was so different from what we were used to. The space was lit like an office, not dimly lit like most American bars. All around us we heard debates and discussions and what sounded like poetry being recited near the back. It was most cool. "Excuse me," I heard a voice say behind me in a heavy Irish brogue. "Can you let me in to get me a pint?" I turned in the direction of the voice and saw the most interesting specimen of a man standing beside me. He had a full red beard, wild wavy hair, and freckled fair skin. He reminded me of the actor Richard Harris. He ordered his Guinness, a dark brown, almost black liquid with a 2-inch creamy head that stuck to his mustache on the first sip. We started to talk. So that was the beginning of my relationship with Ivor, which continued and ended up in Ireland. But you'll have to read the book to find out what happens after that. Part three, I am back in Cambridge after having survived my escapade in Ireland. And it's there that I really began to explore my art, and I took a course at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education in silk screening, which was held at the teacher's studio in North Cambridge, and it really changed my life, and it put me on a path towards being the artist that I wanted to be. So this is part 3, chapter 8, A Community of Artists. My mentor, Anna, who taught me the art of silkscreen, lived in a room behind our communal studio on Harvey Street in North Cambridge. She was going back to school at Cranbrook to get her MFA and asked if I would like to sublet her room. The rent would be cheaper than my current rent in Brookline, and it would be much more convenient to live where I worked, so I grabbed the opportunity and moved once again. The building was originally a French language primary school, an old three-story brick building that housed 10 artist studios, most of which were also the artists' domiciles. Our studio was on the top floor, one of two large shared open spaces. Living in Cambridge was more of an inner city experience than Brookline. My beat up old station wagon, Lizzie, had been broken into twice and towed once in my first month there. Arriving home late in the evening after drinks at the Plow, I would snap on the light and run to the sink to surprise any lingering cockroaches and sadistically squash them or wash them down the drain. Strange animals visibly invaded my space with flapping and scratching noises in the wall, and an occasional brave little mouse wandered around the apartment looking for a meal. But I loved living in the People's Republic of Cambridge in the midst of artists and other random misfits. I loved being able to work in my studio any time of night or day, especially when sleep evaded me. I felt at home in this community of artists I now inhabited. We shared space and equipment and goals. It was the old back to the land commune idea, taken a step further. All those grand ideas from the Portland days became real again, but in a different way. Politics and art together, not politics dictating art, as Sam would have it, or art turning its back on politics, but the two working together for a better world. And this is a journal entry, which are interspersed throughout the book. February 2nd, 1977. Dear Kurt Vonnegut / Kilgore Trout, listen, when I was fresh out of college, I joined a commune, a false carouse, a back-to-the-land commune whose spiritual leader was Scott Nearing. We were all there for the same reason, but we had different motives. The commune died. So it goes. Listen, let a community be built where art and politics can meet, where the world can see an example of how to treat its people better. So after my experiences in the arts community in Cambridge, I ended up in the little town of Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire, with a man who was my pole opposite. He was a Vietnam vet, a staunch conservative Republican, and a gun owner and IRA member. But there was a very strong sexual attraction, so that was part of it. And part of it was that he was offering me the life I had been looking for. He was building a house. He wanted me to help him build a house, to settle in, and that was the life I was living for, so I went for it. But it didn't last but a year. And then it was time to move on again. So this is another journal entry about making that decision. April 26, 1981. Leaving the country, the clean air, the lack of traffic and congestion, and accelerated pace of living, and the fantasy of finally settling down, having a home, having roots, being something other than a transient going through the many phases of living, but wanting instead a nest, a home, a family. I cried almost the whole way back to Fitzwilliam. I looked at the apple tree outside the kitchen window and cried for the loss of seeing it bloom. I looked at this house that I have sweated over and dreamed about and felt a pang of incompleteness. And as Brian has begun to really be kind and loving once again, I remembered why I loved him and why I moved here. I dread the transition from a potentially gorgeous 5-room house to a definitely dumpy 2-room expensive apartment. I try to remind myself of the horrors of existence with Brian those past months. But his lovingness and attention and support and willingness to try are weakening me. But it is all a ploy to get me to stay. Or has he learned something in the last few months? I had dreams of a finished guest room where my friends and sisters could come and stay, The beds made up of clean sheets dried in the country wind, fresh towels laid out at the end of the bed, simple yet elegant meals on the deck outside the kitchen, holidays spent around a roaring fire, the warmth of home and love exuding. I'm so tired of saying, okay, that one didn't work. Tired of moving on. I can't quite give up the fantasy, even in the face of rejection, anger, and abuse. Ah, the tortured artist, forever searching, never finding, wanting so much from life and never getting it, always on the run. So, and then soon after that, I did leave. And part five is where I move to Gloucester. And I ended up in Gloucester because I wanted to open a craft store where I could sell my own crafts and crafts of my friends who I knew from Cambridge. So I got a little store on Bearskin Neck and opened a shop and lived in the back of it and sold my things and was able to make a go of it, even though not much of a go of it. It was a difficult time. It was right around the gas crisis and the recession in the 80s, so it was a little bit of a struggle. And here I met Ken, and Ken was a sailor, and he had dreams of sailing around the world in his sailboat, which he was in the midst of building. And this is chapter 4, called Maiden Voyage, the first time we took the boat out. At last, Elsa was a sailing vessel, and I was learning to sail. We had stocked the boat with food and other necessities for the voyage, and I had hired someone to watch the shop while I was gone. The plan was to sail to Casco Bay off Portland, where Ken's parents had retired on the island of Little Chabig, making several stops along the way. On the Tuesday after Labor Day, we rose early and readied the boat. We motored out of the inner harbor under overcast skies and choppy seas. I was so ready for the adventure. But as we motored past Halibut Point and into the open ocean, the seas became considerably larger and pounded the hull of the Elsa. It felt like a roller coaster ride, slowly climbing to the top of a swell and then crashing down on the other side. It was exhilarating. And with total trust in the captain, I feared not. I went below to grab some more coffee and was thrown back and forth while watching things fly off the shelves. I gave up on coffee and went back on deck and saw an unsettled look on Ken's face. "We have to turn back," he said. "With these seas and this wind, we won't make much progress. I hate to disappoint you, sweetie, but we're heading back to port." I was disappointed, but knew it was the right decision. When we awoke the next morning on the mooring, the skies were clear, the seas were calm, and the sun sparkled across the water of the harbor. We motored easily out of Smith Cove, past the boulevard, and headed toward the cut bridge. As we waited for the bridge to open, I marveled at the difference a day makes and how vulnerable sailors are to the weather. We hauled the sails in the Annisquam River, and the wind was with us as we sailed past Halibut Point, cleared Rockport, and entered the open ocean. Soon we were beyond the sight of land, a huge expanse of sparkling seas stretching in all directions. The quiet was immense. The only sounds were the ruffling of the sails and the gentle lapping of the water on the bow. I would see a buoy off in the distance, and would be mystified by the amount of time it seemed to take to reach it, how its clanging got louder as we approached, and gradually subsided as we moved beyond it. It was as if we were in a film running in ultra-slow motion. I was transported away from my cares and worries that lived back on land. I felt free and at peace. And, of course, that relationship didn't end well. And mostly because I was still extremely intent on being a mother. I really wanted to have children. And he did not want children. And there was just no moving either one of us. So we finally decided that was it. We couldn't do more. So this is another journal entry, November 22nd, 1989. the eve of my 40th birthday, a long-dreaded event about to unfold. Unable to halt its coming by standing on the tracks and flailing my arms, I've got to either jump on board or get squished. You're supposed to have it all together by the time you reach 40. You're supposed to have your shit together. And from my middle-class roots, that meant by now I should be married with a child or two and have my career in place, own a home, and probably be working on acquiring a summer home and be worried about paying for my children's education. Stop. Of the above resume, the only thing I can own is the home. None of the rest. I guess I've got to get back to the serenity prayer. I've got to start accepting the things I cannot change, change the things I can, and let the rest go. I have to have the courage to change my situation by getting artificially inseminated, or I could accept the fact that maybe God wants me to be childless, or I could join a dating service and hope to meet Mr. Right. Or maybe I should just forget it. I wish I had some answers. Age doesn't necessarily bring wisdom. My sisters had planned a surprise 40th birthday party for me. Well, it was supposed to be a surprise. They had left it up to Thomas to get me there, and Thomas decided to tell me what was up instead of keeping the secret. He had no use for mundane things like surprise parties. Consequently, I arrived dressed for a party and feigned surprise. My sisters had convinced Thomas to purloin my address book and copy the pages. It seemed everyone I knew was there. Old friends from high school, relatives, co-workers, past and present, friends from Gloucester. It was a truly festive event. I felt honored and grateful for all the wonderful people in my life. This birthday marked a huge milestone for me. 40, the purported end of my childbearing years. If the experts were to be believed, well beyond the marker of the decline of fertility, age 35. On the way back to Gloucester in Thomas's car, I knew the time had come. I needed to make some decisions. I needed to evaluate this relationship with Thomas honestly and have a frank discussion with him about the future. Despite what my heart told me, my head told me that if I really wanted a child and a family, Thomas was not a viable candidate. Where did that knowledge leave me? What next? Thomas was also someone who really didn't want to have children, and he was also 13 years younger than me, so we were at different places in our lives. So this is part 7, the last part, and I'm going to read chapter 1, Contemplation. The title of the workshop at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education caught my attention. Last Call for Motherhood. Are you a woman over 35 that has always thought motherhood would be part of your life, but it has yet to come to pass? Are you willing to contemplate becoming a single mother by choice? Despite the potential disapproval of family and friends, if you would like to devote some time and emotional effort into answering these questions for yourself, join us on Saturday, May 15th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. for an all-day workshop. Bring a lunch and a notebook and a willingness to share your deepest thoughts. I immediately signed up. It was just what I needed to help me figure out if, in fact, single motherhood was the right path for me. In a small room, I sat with 5 other anxious women as we silently awaited the arrival of the instructor. There was an aura of shame surrounding our shared situation. We didn't speak and avoided eye contact. Merle, the instructor, was a licensed social worker and part of a group practice specializing in fertility counseling. She was a short woman with frizzy black hair, just starting to show signs of gray. Despite her short stature, she had a confident air and a commanding, kind voice. After introducing herself, she handed out her guidelines for decision-making. Number 1, calm your panic. You don't have to decide today. 2, use both sides of your brain, the creative and the practical. That shouldn't be difficult for me. Number 3, analyze your motivations. Been doing that for years. Number 4, do your grief work before you make your decision. Grief work? Number 5, plan your support system. My sisters, Eileen. 6, talk to people in your life about the decision you are leaning towards and observe their reactions. This may uncover unexpected results. The goal of today's workshop is to come away with a better idea of your options and provide you with the tools to help you in making your decision. Your options are adoption, international and domestic, artificial insemination by donor, using a known donor, either through insemination or getting pregnant the old-fashioned way by someone you know, or deciding to remain childless by choice and being at peace with that decision. Each option has its own advantages and disadvantages, and we will spend this morning exploring them in depth. So that was my beginning of my path to single motherhood, which my son is now 27, and it was an interesting journey. It was an interesting journey to get to where I was at the end of this book, and I'm hoping to do another book about the whole experience of being a single mother. Thank you very much.